With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Castlecomer, my hometown, is a pretty unusual place. Today, it's really picturesque. It's got a growing tourist industry. The old landlord's private woodland has been turned into the Castlecomer Discovery Park. But these are only recent developments. Until the later 20th century, it was one of Ireland's few mining towns. Generation after generation of families from Castlecomer and the surrounding region worked in dangerous conditions, which led to a volatile history in the region. I've covered some of this in a series I made back in 2015. It's in the show notes below. However, that series only brought the story up until 1921, leaving out what is arguably the most interesting chapter in Castlecomer's history. After dominating life in the town for 300 years, the Wandesford family faced an unprecedented challenge as the miners organised and demanded a change in their living conditions. This movement was led by a man who was revered by many in Castlecomer, even when I was growing up in the 1980s and 90s. Nicholas Bourne, known as Nixie, was born in 1904. Too young to fight in the Irish War of Independence, he did fight alongside Dan Breen in the Irish Civil War. In the 1920s, Nixie was radicalised by the likes of Padraig O'Donnell and gravitated towards communism. As you'll hear in this episode, this would take this man from rural Ireland to the Soviet Union in 1930, before he returned to face an onslaught from the combined might of the Catholic Church, the Irish Free State, and the mine owners in Castlecomer. In this episode, I interview Nixie Bourne's daughter, Anne, about his life. Anne has recently published a book on her father, Challenging Power, Nixie Bourne, 1904 to 1971, which vividly retells the story of his remarkable life. She has amazing insights, not only from her own father, but also interviews she carried out with other miners who played an instrumental role in the history you're about to hear. Now, just before we start the interview, I need to introduce the show for new listeners. My name is Finn Dwyer, and this is the Irish History Podcast. You can find me on socials at Irish History. We've restocked the shop over Christmas, and fittingly for today's show, we have the Starry Plough back in stock, as well as the Cumann na mBan badge and the Padraig O'Donnell badge, which were all sold out. You can find those at irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop. Now, finally, I want to thank Anne for her time. You can get her book, Challenging Power, Nixie Bourne, 1904 to 1971, at Geography Publications. I have an exact link to that in the show notes as well. Sound was by Jason Looney. To start our chat, though, I asked Anne, could you tell me about the conditions of mining in Castlecomer? Because that's really the foundation of the story we're about to hear.
The conditions were unbelievable. And see, by the beginning of the 20th century, deep mining had been established. That was established during the 19th century, mid-19th century. So miners had to work increasingly further down underground without adequate ventilation systems, without adequate mechanization, certainly without health and safety regulations as we would know them today. So the conditions, I looked at some of the records of accidents, and it was just amazing how frequent accidents were. They were part and parcel of the everyday life of a miner. You know, it would be arm broken in several places or leg broken by a rock fall or fingers crushed or, you know, incredible amount of and constant. And almost every miner I spoke to spoke about times when they were off. I remember talking to Tom Rowe, and he said, you know, when that strike was on, I had just started in the mine, and I was in hospital because I'd broken my leg in three places underground, you know. So it was a constant part of their life and seemed to be accepted.
This life began at the age of 14 for boys in the town.
The boys in the area would leave school at age 14, head into the mines. You know, well, and they were expected to do so.
Along with the harsh conditions, employment in the mines was highly unstable. As Anne now explains, wages were indexed to the price of coal, meaning they fluctuated depending on wider economic conditions.
Also, interestingly enough, their wages were linked to what they call a sliding scale that depended on the market price of coal. So if the coal prices were high, then their wages might be increased by a certain amount, depending on how much the price of coal had risen. And their wages would decrease as well when the price of coal was lower.
To make matters worse, the mine owners, the Wandlesford family, didn't pay them for some of the coal they mined, even though they were able to sell it.
Then they weren't paid for certain categories of coal. So a lot of coal that went through, they had meshes that they filtered the coal through. And a lot of coal that went through the meshes, the smaller particles of coal, were sold on the market, but they weren't paid for them. It wasn't included in their tonnage when their wages were calculated. So they had lots of issues. And at that stage, they didn't seem to have any power to exercise control over their conditions. They tended to be dictated to, really, by Wandlesford at the time, and later by Wandlesford management when it became a private company.
While this is the backdrop to the story, now we turn to Nixie himself. He was born in 1904. He came to adulthood around 1921, just as the War of Independence was coming to an end. While the conflict itself had an impact on life in North Kilkenny, there was also bitter conflict between workers and employers in the mines. The kidnapping of two mine managers and then industrial sabotage resulted in the mine being closed for several months.
The experiences of that particular year of 1921 to 22 meant that there was even more turmoil, let's say, in mining during the War of Independence. There was a lot of strife in the mines. The mine had been closed for about 6 months of that year because there had been the aerial roping had been cut. Mining managers had been captured and taken away by armed men and hidden for a couple of months to put pressure on Wandlesford to change conditions in the mines.
The lack of work saw Nixie take employment where he could find it. The Irish Civil War began in the summer of 1922, and the Free State Army were desperate for recruits. Nixie signed up, however, it didn't sit well with his developing politics. During the War of Independence, he had been an active supporter of the IRA, and now he found himself fighting some former allies. Nixie eventually would switch sides, starting a fascinating political journey.
Many of the miners went into the Free State Army. My father went in with his brother, signed up in Kilkenny, and he was sent to Tipperary shortly after that. Now, in Tipperary, he, of course, was fighting against people who had been former allies. And I think he found it very disturbing. It wasn't an easy decision which side to opt for in the Civil War, because many of them went with their leadership, within the IRA companies, for example, if there were very strong leaders and they had a very defined position in relation to the treaty, sometimes they just went along with them. But they had a lot in common, the people they were fighting against, especially you had the early days. There was a lot of reluctance to kill the opposition. So he was fighting against people who would have been natural allies in the past. He didn't like, I think, the position that the government took in relation to the Republicans as they became known. And if people defected, they could be shot, for example. They could be condemned to death. If they were found with arms, they could be condemned to death. It was a very radical stance of the Free State government to adopt those policies. And that led to many people moving across to the Republican side from the Free State Army. And my father walked out of his barracks in Carrick in December of 1922, and he joined Dan Breen's men. So he was then a guerrilla fighter, I guess, on Dan Breen's side in the Civil War.
After he was seriously wounded in the Civil War, he was taken to hospital. However, in the same ward where he was recuperating, there were several Free State soldiers. If recognised, Nixie would have been sentenced to death given he had switched sides in the conflict. To evade recognition, he took on an assumed identity, calling himself James Ryan.
And he had a backstory, in which he had fallen off a hayrick and he'd cut himself on the side. And that explained the injury to his leg. And of course, unfortunately for him, the Bishop of Limerick visited. And he tried to pretend he was asleep, but the bishop insisted that he wanted to say hello to all of the men, sympathise with their injuries, etc. So he began asking him where he was from, and he was fine initially, but then he wanted to know what bishop had confirmed him. And he had no idea, of course, what bishop confirmed him, so he stuttered a bit and stumbled, and the matron that was accompanying the bishop said, you know, he hit his head when he fell, so he's a bit confused. And the bishop accepted that fine and blessed him and went on his way. But of course the three Free State soldiers knew he wasn't a bit confused, so they let it be known that he would be picked up shortly. So then it was on to get him out of there and away as quickly as possible. And Cumann na mBan got on the job. Then the matron obviously was in Cumann na mBan and knew his real story. So they got him to, he went to the chapel. I told him to go to the chapel. He had to get dressed in a toilet, and he said how difficult it was to try and dress himself after being immobile for so long, and to try and then walk naturally. And he was told to sit behind somebody who would then get up and walk out, and he was to follow that person, which he did, and she led him to a station, and he got on the train to Limerick Junction. And I think it was there that Dan Breen and Ginny Lacey took him off the train and got him to they were very flamboyant in their arrests and they got him to a safe house, and he recovered, then came back on to continue fighting.
During the Civil War, Nixie fought alongside Dan Breen. Now Breen, as you might know from the War of Independence series, is an almost legendary figure. Although Nixie was disturbed by his cavalier attitude to violence and grew to dislike the IRA commander.
Even my memory, you know, of him speaking about Dan Breen was never very positive. He seemed to be one that they feared and admired in equal measure, if you know what I mean. And he would he does tell some stories that were very unflattering about Dan Breen, and one of them was shooting a Free State soldier in the middle of an act of contrition while he was kneeling on the ground, and that disturbed him. There was another one that he said he was very lucky to escape with his life because there was a widow's son who's been accused of having betrayed them and been the cause of an ambush. And the widow was pleading for the son's life, and my father put the case to Dan Breen that he didn't think that he was responsible for the, and so he didn't kill him on the spot. He said they'd look into it further, but if he was wrong, that he would shoot my father instead. So he said God was on his side, and they discovered that it was somebody totally different that had betrayed.
The Civil War came to an end in the summer of 1923 with defeat for Nixie and the Republican forces. He would spend the following year on the run, only openly returning to Castlecomer in the mid-1920s, but life wasn't easy.
Then he came back to mining, and of course he discovered that he had a difficulty getting a job. He got one in Skahana, and that's where he first began to take strike action. You know, he encouraged people to go out because of some issue in the mines, and he was sacked because he was attempting to get them to organise to defend whatever it was. And all the men went out to support him, and they reinstated him. Now, that was one of the first concessions Wannesford would have given. So they seem to have seen him very quickly as a leader, and he seemed to be quite tenacious and courageous in the line he took. And I think he probably was a good arguer of positions, and they had confidence in him. So that was the beginning of his leadership role.
This began a new chapter in his life, but the Irish Civil War had psychologically scarred Nixie Bourne. His experiences shaped his worldview for the rest of his life. While he would adopt an extremely militant approach in the mines in terms of organising the workers, he never advocated violent tactics.
He would have had very rough experiences, I think, in reality, that would have, I would say, traumatised him to some extent. He never encouraged people to fight, you know, physically, or to blow up, or to do, you know, they went much more into strike action that involved arguments and putting the facts forward and being probably intransigent in sticking to their guns about what it is they wanted to change. You know, they became very organised. He had a particular approach, I think, to organisation that didn't involve the violence. And I often, and Annie, actually, one of the miners pointed that out to me, and said, I think that had to do with his experiences during the Civil War and the impact of violence on people.
His politics also changed during his time on the run. As Anne now explains, her father was increasingly exposed to left-wing ideas, those of James Connolly, through other Republicans such as Pather O'Donnell.
And I think when he was on the run particularly, you know, they had their own network of people. He became involved with the left of the IRA in that period. And of course, Pather O'Donnell was one of the key people there. And I think he began to think about, because Pather was a socialist, communist, probably that sort of thinking. And he also had a picture of what he'd like for a free Ireland. Now, their ideas were built on Connolly. And Nixie would have been exposed to Connolly's thinking through the Irish Transport and General Workers Union that they had attempted to organise with. They would have been exposed to Connolly's notion of, you know, you don't just change the masters, it has to be more than that, otherwise you just change a green coat, a red coat for a green coat, and nothing fundamentally changes. The workers have to have a say in a free Ireland. So he had this idea of nationalism and socialism combined, you know, that would give equality to within a new Ireland. So that resonated really with miners, you know, and it resonated really with him. And of course, Pada was in that line of thinking, but he also had the additional element of wanting kind of farmers and workers, small farmers and workers, to work together to a kind of, to form his ideal scenario would be a farmers' workers' republic, you know, that would work under socialist ideas.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now, the wider global context is crucial to understanding these developments. By 1925, communism was on the march around the world. In Moscow, the Bolsheviks had emerged victorious in the Russian Civil War, which inspired workers across the world. This was only strengthened when capitalism plunged into a deep crisis at the end of the decade and seemed on the verge of collapse to many.
And capitalism was under strain. You know, you had huge unemployment in across the world. And it looked like the capital system was creaking, was breaking. And of course, there was optimism on the Russian side that this was a good sign, that there would, you know, there was going to be scope for a different kind of society in the future. That's what they thought. It was on the point of collapse.
It was in this wider context that the Castlecomer miners, who worked in appalling conditions and were now led by Nixie, were drawn into the emerging Irish communist movement. In 1929, the miners would raise money to send Nixie to visit the Soviet Union and attend a meeting of left-wing trade unions.
Then they began to think about organising again in terms of a union. And they obviously had connections with revolutionary workers' groups that were being set up in Dublin. And there was a major conference, Red International of Labour Union Conference in Moscow in August of 1930. And they were inviting leaders from around the world to go to this conference, during which they would be able to discuss communist ideas and they would be able to see what was happening in Russia. And then the miners wanted to send him. And they raised enough money to send him to Russia. And he applied for a passport. Of course, that was refused. And it was very interesting because I was able to access some of the documentation, the background documentation of this, and the discussion between the Minister for Foreign Affairs and the Minister of Justice about whether they should give, issue him a passport. And anyway, they decided no, they wouldn't give him a passport. So he was meant to go with a group of other people who were friends of the Soviet Russia, they were called. But because he couldn't get a passport, he couldn't go with them. So they went separately. And he stowed away on a cement ship and had quite an adventurous journey to Russia. It was the ship got involved in a storm and he was blown way off course, and he ended up where he shouldn't have ended up, and he had to travel across Russia to Moscow. And he attended the conference, and of course it was such an exciting thing for them, you know, meeting leaders from all over the world. And he met the mine leaders the leader of the Scottish mine workers, the Welsh mine workers. You know, he got to know all of these people and could draw on their support, you know, over time. Then he visited the Lenin School, of course, when he was there, and Sean Murray, and Jim Larkin Jr. were there, and that, of course, he became friends with them, and they really helped out in the early days of organization. You know, when they came back to Ireland, they were being formed, let's say, in sort of communist thinking, and they were meant to be the leaders, the vanguard, as they called them, of leadership back in their own country, that would set up revolutionary workers' groups and ultimately would set up a communist party in Ireland. So that was the general broad plan.
Now, many of the people Nixie met at this conference were from some of the most powerful communist movements in the world. The German Communist Party, for example, were the third largest party in Germany, taking 13% of the vote in an election that year. Nixie, however, was returning to a very different context in rural Ireland. In North Kilkenny, he would find an extremely hostile reception waiting for him when he returned home from the Soviet Union. While the mine owners and the government were deeply conservative, it was the Catholic Church who would ultimately lead the charge against him and the other radical miners in the area.
The priests knew that he had gone to Russia, and he came back with a bit of fanfare and was arrested and all the rest. But the miners were very, they were ready for action, I guess. They seemed to be delighted that he had gone, and he immediately began to tell them about all the what he discovered, and he was quite open about it. an openness in those situations leads to attack from all sides, doesn't it? So the parish priest worked on the local area very effectively, and also coordinated with the bishop and with some key people in Kilkenny, you know, that were very media savvy, like Father Coleman.
Nixie faced an added problem of finding work. He wanted to organise the miners, but there was no way Richard Henry Wandesford, the mine owner, was going to hire him.
And of course he couldn't get a job in the mines because Wandesford didn't want him, that's for sure. But he was elected check weighman, which is a position that the miners actually pay for. So they employed him. So he won that position. He had to compete for it, but he did win that position, which gave him of course, he was in a good position then to organise miners. And they started to set up the union and get advice, and they had a constitution from the Scottish Mine Workers Union that Willie Allen had given Nixie in Russia. So, you know, he talks about how radical they were, but he said they felt very strongly. They were very, you know, all these radical ideas appealed to them because they felt that nothing else shifted conditions or seemed able to shift conditions in the neighbourhood. Because when he came back, nothing had changed. You know, a new Ireland, nothing had changed. The Free State government was as repressive as, you know, the British had been. No change. You know, Wanneswood still dominated the local area. It was an interesting situation. Here was this group of, well, they were regarded as ignorant miners, challenging the power that be, you know, at every level. And of course the state came in and they harassed them by searching the houses and, you know, all of that, and keeping a very close eye on them. Of course, religion was so important in Ireland. You know, it was so important. They lived by the dictates of the church. And of course, they had, the church took a very strong line too. I suppose the popes had disgusted Leo the 13th and also Pius the 11th. And you had Quadragesimo Anno that kind of came out with the key statement, you couldn't be a communist and a Catholic at the same time. And of course, that the bishop used very effectively against them.
Now, this issue of religion would prove very difficult for the miners. Indeed, many activists across the left in Ireland in the 1930s struggled to find a way to reconcile communist beliefs with their deeply held Catholic faith. In the Castlecomer region, some of the miners had to cycle to churches some distance away from their homes, and in some cases, they were also refused the sacraments, which was deeply troubling to them.
They used cycle further afield to Mass on Sunday because they weren't welcome in their own church. Paddy Carr was one of the key foundation members of the committee, the early first committee. His son told me that he went to confession to the parish priest and he refused to give him absolution because he was involved in this movement, this union. Imagine. You know, which is a very radical thing, isn't it? You know, sort of, even from a church teaching perspective, is quite a thing. So they were hit, you know, and of course this affected radically their families. Can you imagine the families, especially the more religious ones, who maybe didn't engage with the social side of things, social teaching, or human rights side of things, which in a sense the pontiffs, the popes did. They admitted that capitalism got it very wrong in many ways, but they felt that the church had the answers. And I guess capitalists should voluntarily come in line and treat their workers better.
Nevertheless, they remained determined. And with the support of the likes of Padraig O'Donnell and James Larkin Jr., they did win some successes in the 1930s. However, this only led to a more intensified and bitter conflict with the Catholic Church, and the Bishop of Ossory himself would come to the area to denounce them.
Well, when the pressure was piling on and the union had their first strike and their first minor success, with the help of people like Padraig O'Donnell and Jim Larkin Jr. coming down to Castlecomer to speak in the square to support the miners, etc. They got a little concession of a raise in wages, yeah, and they began to talk big. I guess we're heading for success now, and so. I think the church were very keen to kill that off very quickly. And so the bishop was invited out to Monin Row to address the community. And they put a guard of honour kind of outside the church to stop the miners going in. And they were conveying, really, that these were dangerous men that shouldn't be allowed in, that there was a threat in some way to the bishop. So the miners had organised a bit ahead of time. A couple of miners stood behind each of the people who were forming the guard of honour outside the church door. And one of them, Fitzgerald, I think his name was, meant to have said, "The first man to touch Bourne, I'll drop him." So nobody touched Bourne as he walked in with some of the other miners' leaders. So they walked into the church and sat down as a member of that congregation. But of course, the bishop was going to humiliate them one way or another. So he preached against communism, of course, to the churchgoers. And then he made them renew their baptismal vows. "I renounce Satan," etc. And it was aimed directly at the miners to denounce what because they regarded communism as Satan, the instrument of Satan. So they had to renounce them in front of the rest of the churchgoers, the whole community. So the miners stood up and walked out at that stage. So the feelings were very strong. And of course, that intensified the feelings within the community, because, you know, one of the miners, the Walters, said, they said, "That poor man coming out," you know, no, it wasn't the Walters, they were, they seemed very firm and committed, including their mother. Well, one of the other miners said, "That poor man coming out in the wet and cold, you know, because you're creating such trouble." And of course, he came across with he should be preaching religion and not politics. So they recognized there was a difference, you know, that in fact it was the bishop was being very political by trying to kill off the movement at that point. They were saying it wasn't really about religion.
While his views changed a lot in the coming decades, and this is something really well explained in Anne's book, she weaves in much larger debates into Nixie's personal story. We couldn't cover everything in the interview. So I did want to ask Anne, though, about some of the successes of the miners. While the 1930s were by and large a time of defeat, by the late 1940s, things had changed in the mines. After decades of organising, the miners, led by Nixie, issued a series of demands, and when they weren't met, they walked out on strike, beginning what would become one of the longest labour disputes in Irish history.
Well, they first of all raised some of the issues, and Wanisford refused to consider what they were proposing. You know, they had concrete proposals about how much examining how the price of coal had risen in line with the sliding scale that seemed to operate sometimes on and sometimes off, where their wages should be in general. And when it became a very long drawn out strike, over the course of which there were many campaigns to get the miners to go back. And some of these were aimed at, for example, offering them special concessions at Christmas, looked like great wages, if they would come in and then commit to continue afterwards. And the miners refused to allow anybody. I think one 14-year-old turned up. So that was defeated. And then they offered, they put a bus on that would go around all the areas, and they called it the ghost bus to try and get people in. So they had various elements. The union came very supportive of the miners, even though it was such a prolonged strike. They supported them in every way. And the employers, like the company, had their employers' union. So there was negotiations going on at every stage. And then they had the Labour Court came down to Moaning Row to try and negotiate with the men. They were trying to get them to go back, and then they would give them concessions. And they were very firm that they wouldn't go back. There was no way they would go back until they got the concessions. And then they would offer concessions to one group of workers, but not to the others. And it looked reasonable, you know, they would go back and they would go into the mines and they would look at conditions, they would look at all their issues once they were back. And they would say, no, you know, they would have the big meeting, the miners would vote. And this went on for 11 months. And they must have been weary out. Absolutely weary. You know, I mean, I would say the mothers probably were weary, you know, having to have the shopkeepers giving them tick, you know, we'll pay when we get money, etc. Which they did. They were very accommodating and supportive of them.
The miners would eventually win most of their demands. And by the 1950s, they worked in conditions that would have been unrecognisable to their fathers.
They entered into the most probably prosperous period of the next decade, which was fantastically successful. They felt they were vindicated probably for decades of battling for their rights, that here was a package that they could, everybody could be behind, and they felt they could have a decent standard of living, decent conditions in the mines, etc. So they felt very successfully, and they are very successful, and I think proud of themselves for having the tenacity to last it. And that was probably one of the key features of my father, but he wouldn't have been able to do it without the support of the people around. They were really fantastic. I mean, I would have to say I was so impressed by them. You know, the fact that any of those committee could stand up and put the clear, true picture of the background information that clarified what their claims were based on. And when looked at officially, then they couldn't be denied, you know, in a sense. The facts and evidence were on their side. Mm-hmm. So I think they were their proudest achievement, probably.
To end the interview, I asked Anne to summarise her father and his remarkable life.
Nixie was, he's hard to sum up, isn't it? Because, you know, in one sense, he was a flawed person in many ways. You know, he made many mistakes through life. But I think he was one person who learned from mistakes. And he didn't let go of what was important, what he felt really needed to change in life. And it was an interesting thing that before he died, he did say, you know, he was ready. He felt that he had done all he set out to do in life. Very few of us can say that, you know, and I think he felt that. He had done as much as he could do for his life, and it was other people then would have to take up the mantle of the next battles, etc., you know.
What we covered today in this interview only touches on Nixie Boren's remarkable story. You can get Challenge to Power, Nixie Boren, 1904 to 1971, from Geography Publications in the show notes below. Thanks for tuning in. That's where I'm going to leave it for this week's show. Until next time, Sloan.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.